Well, if we're honest, there is no agreement about how we should look at the world. It's not too difficult to find contrasting, differing versions. Amalnona is the Chaldean Archbishop of Mosul in northern Iraq. He's exiled at the moment in Erbil as the Islamic State took over the city of Mosul. And he was speaking the other day to the Western media and contrasting the way people view the world and people. This is what he said. He said, your liberal and democratic principles are worth nothing here. You think all men are equal, but that's not true. Islam doesn't say that all men are equal. Your values are not their values. Richard Dawkins, the Oxford professor, who kind of takes his logic all the way, doesn't it, to the starkest ends, which is why in the end he often lands up disagreeing with his friends. He says this, we're machines built by DNA whose purpose is to make more copies of the same DNA. This is exactly what we're for. We're machines for propagating DNA, and the propagation of DNA is a self-sustaining process. It's every living object's sole reason for living. Well, you contrast that with the New Testament with its very different take. All things have been created through him and for him. I was at a meeting last week of a group called Christians in Politics, and MPs from all parties spoke of keeping Christian integrity as a politician being not as difficult as many people imagine. One MP said this. She said, everyone in politics is expected to have a worldview, and a Christian worldview is a consistent one. Well, the worldview may be consistent, but we rarely are, if we're honest, are we? In fact, the way we view the world can often be an almost incoherent jumble. I mean, sometimes our look is shaped by our philosophy, our religion, whatever. Sometimes we just react instinctively. We go with our gut feel. We respond the way we've always been brought up to think and feel. Other times, we just drift with the crowd. Our view is coloured by the fact that everyone thinks like that. And the aim of this series is to take a fresh look at our familiar world, to try and look through God's eyes, the God of the Bible's eyes, to put substance behind some instincts and prejudices perhaps, and no doubt to correct and right others. And the series is intended to hang together, as each week we look at a different plank which put together form the foundation of a Christian worldview. Or to put it another way, as we look through the lens of the camera, each week we'll adjust the lens until the world is fully in focus. A world that, to be seen in its sharpest light, needs to be seen, as this series develops, as created, but also as broken and reconciled and renewed. Each adjustment to the lens should allow us to see and understand our world and ourselves more clearly. And each week we'll look at the impact these truths have on the way we see life. But tonight we're starting with the truth about being created and this being God's world. It's one scientist began his book this way. He said, every Christian, whatever scientific views they've got, every Christian is by definition a creationist. By which he meant no more and no less than that back of it all, God made it. I mean, it's why one of the great baptismal questions is, do you believe in God the Father who made the world? Now, of course, when we mention creation, never mind Genesis 1, it often generates more heat than light. And when I read articles and books where the author trades his science with their science, I always wince and fear they're going to miss the point. Because the primary concern of the Bible is with the who and the why, not the how. And when it tackles the how, it doesn't answer it in scientific terms. Because it's concerned to tell us truth about God. I mean, the Genesis account, vivid writing, highly stylized, surveys the making of the cosmos and the filling of it with all kinds of living things. One of our Sunday school children, typical of the way children spot the obvious, which we often miss, heard the history of Genesis 1 and said, oh, that must have been an awful lot of work for God. But read the account, and you'll see that it doesn't just tell us we have a God who works hard and creatively. It's also clear we have one God. There isn't room for any more than the God spoken of there. I mean, why worship the sun and the trees and the animals when you can worship the God who made them all? The Old Testament consistently takes up this theme and insists on it. We parody the God of the Old Testament sometimes, don't we? We reduce him to the God of the Jews, the God of Israel. But it insists he's the God of the world. He's the Lord of the heaven and earth. This God is not tribal. He's universal. And nothing changes when you get to the New Testament. See, this passage in Colossians 1 links Jesus, the Son, the image of the invisible God, inextricably with the God who made the cosmos. And you see what it says in verse 16? For in him all things were created, and he means all. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. And if you think the powers are the powers of this world or of the spirit world, it really doesn't matter. All things have been created through him and for him. See, from Caesars to spirits and angels, this is the one who created them all. Worship him. It means, too, there's no area in creation outside of his concern and interest, which the more you think about it, the scarier that idea gets. You know, from politics to the environment, from social concerns to lifestyle choices, we take religion and use it to focus on church and its activities, but the God of the Bible starts with the world and giving us a whole world to enjoy and explore. And he doesn't just set up the laws, get the process going, and then put his feet up in a deck chair and restrict himself to an occasional drop of oil to keep things running smoothly either. There is a present tense to creation as well. In the Old Testament, God's involved in the sustaining, reproductive, creative process too. He made, yes, and he makes. And it's here too in Colossians 1, look at verse 17. He is before all things, yes, but in him all things hold together now. He's the sustainer God. Or as the apostle put it to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17, he himself gives everyone life and breath. Look, if God's world shows us truth about God, you don't have to look very far to discover it also shows us truth about us. You see, it's not just that God made us, but as you'll know well from Genesis 1, God created mankind in his own image. It's as if each one of us has made in his image stamped on us. Oh, as we'll see next week, it's faded. It's battered, it's bruised, it's distorted, but it's not eradicated. Which is why I shouldn't be surprised when I discover goodness in the most unlikely of people. Now, why do bad people still do good things? Well, because the image is not entirely removed. And we need to stop speaking or thinking as if it has been. Now, Jesus made the point himself when he said, if you, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, he could handle the tension. See, how do I think of people? Well, start here, made in the image of God. And don't let it be forgotten. James, in his letter, challenges our hypocrisy in James chapter 3. He says this, with the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. Brothers and sisters, this should not be. Here's a couple of public challenges that have come to my notice in the last few days. A week ago yesterday, the English Defence League held a protest opposite the BBC, but on our steps. Too much of their rhetoric is unacceptable. Immigration is going to be one of the big issues in next year's general election. It's a subject full of fears and worries and concerns, as well as opportunities and enrichments. But we mustn't allow or tolerate fears to degenerate into kind of racist stereotyping, ethnic demeaning, as if they and them, unlike us, you know, were not made in the image of God. Or again, this last week has seen gender-selective abortions hit the media. People having abortions because their babies are female, not male. That's the reason given, as if that were a reason to despise and to deem unwanted. And it's in this country. In fact, on Tuesday, an MP is putting a bill before Parliament to confirm that gender-selective abortions are illegal. You see, in the Genesis 1 account, what God says is this: God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them, both in the image of God, together in the image of God. Equality laws can be a dirty word in some Christian circles, and the way some of them have been applied at times makes that understandable. But there are equalities of value and worth that start with this truth: God made us in his image. Look at any human being, and for all the ethnic, gender, moral differences even, for all the vulnerabilities and frailties you might see, start here. In the image of God, he created them. Well, there's more, of course, than just the idea that creation means we live in God's world. It also means that God's world is our world. Not just because we live in it, but we've got a vital role in it all, and not the role of just another creature. God's creation commission to those he made in his image is immense, extensive. Be fruitful, he says. Increase, fill the earth, subdue it, rule. See, he's saying we reflect the image of God not just when we show characteristics that are like God of love and goodness and self-sacrifice, but also when we exercise leadership and responsibility in his world, when we rule. So what does it look like to live with those responsibilities in God's world? Well, it involves, for example, and we can only just kind of touch in on each of these, it involves work. It involves work. I'm sorry, this isn't the sort of rule that's exercised by sitting back on some throne. No sooner is he commissioned than Adam is put to work. In Genesis 2, the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. See, when God saw what he'd made and said that it was good, and very good, he didn't mean that he'd made a manicured world that just needed admiring and not touching. It was made to be worked and taken care of, and we were made to work it. There's an intrinsic value to work, a worth built into us that goes way beyond the petty divisions which creep into our minds when we think, oh, is it paid work or not? Or when we ask, what do you do, and then evaluate according to the answer, you know, banker, secretary, shelf stacker, a teacher. Built into our DNA is the idea that we were made for work. It's part of our created role. And again, perhaps, again, just as surprisingly as you read the early pages of the Bible, God's world is our world and marriage gets involved. This responsibility for the created world is for men and women together. Both receive the same commission. Be fruitful, increase, subdue, rule. If you think about it, it's very hard for human beings to be fruitful and increase without men and women working together. I mean, I don't need to go into the details, do I? No, you can work it out for yourself. And before anything goes wrong in the world, in Genesis 2, not Genesis 3, God provides marriage as the relationship intended for the heart of society and family life. Now, you don't have to be married to exercise a part in this rule. There's more to it than just multiplying and increasing. But to despise it,
grow careless over it.
To distort it as an instrument to reflect male domination is not to have read the Maker's instructions. To reduce marriage to a piece of paper, as some people speak of it, is to reduce it to something that, if you think about it, wasn't even created when marriage was made. And nearly everyone who speaks like that is just being a hypocrite. To sterilize it and define it so that it can't produce children is to take it from the context and the setting in which it was given. Creation means we need to value and cherish marriage. I suspect that our many failures in it have led to us growing increasingly careless about it. Or again, there's what I might call creation care. This idea of rule, you see, doesn't speak of authoritarian dominance. It's more of stewardship of responsible authority. You can't read the Bible account of creation and worship Gaia and Mother Earth. You wouldn't hug every tree and protect it as if it were some deity. Trees were given us for their beauty and their shade, their fruit, and their timber as well. But this rule is not licensed to desecrate and to destroy species and rainforests, to inflict cruelty on God's creatures so that we can have cheap supermarket food. I can argue the science around global warming, and there are times when they've all admitted it needed to be more robust. But I shouldn't be arguing about the need for concern for the planet that God made and gave us, nor the responsibility to sustain coming ahead of the desire to indulge. Now, understand me clearly. I'm not saying this is how to save the planet. Only God in Jesus can do that. As Paul will make clear, I mean, just look down at verse 19, for example. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, Jesus, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed in the cross. Now, how that works out and impacts our responsibilities will come into focus as we keep adjusting the lens in the next few weeks. But tonight, we face the truth of verse 16. All things have been created through him and for him. That there's more to the world than just a stage for us to play out our salvation issues on. That there's something precious about God's creation in all its origins and destiny. We shouldn't trample on it. We're handling his workmanship and his inheritance. People often speak about creation care. They speak less often, but it seems to me it's got to be built in as well about what I've called creation enjoyment. See, there's more than one way to turn our backs on something. We can ignore the responsibility to care and just indulge. Or we can ignore the opportunity to enjoy and just abstain. And they can be two very different ways to narrow life. Here is Paul writing later on to Timothy, and he says this in his letter. He says, for everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. God's given us a good world to enjoy, but we too often ignore it or even give ourselves spiritual reasons for doing so. In the context of the letter, as he writes that chapter to Timothy, he's warning him about people who've abandoned the faith, who are following deceiving spirits, who are hypocritical liars, and what they're saying to their followers is, says Paul, he says, they forbid people to marry. You know, if you're really zealous for the Lord, if you devote yourselves to him and you'll stay single, and reject the gift of marriage. Or they order them to abstain from certain food that God has given us to enjoy. Christians aren't exempt from being so absorbed in religion that we can't enjoy the beauty and the tastes and the relationships that God has provided. Everything God created is good. Nothing to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. You see, creation enjoyment is actually part of the life we're given here. If we're not careful, we can have a worldview that doesn't leave room for a God who's made so many good things for us to enjoy. Or if it leaves room for it in our heads, in practice, we don't make room to actually enjoy them. See, when we reach heaven and you reminisce on life now and God asks, did you see that? Did you enjoy this? I wonder how many red faces there'll be as we have to say, I'm sorry, I never even noticed it. I mean, we may need some of us to do it more often and take a Sabbath and get out of the city and enjoy it. But even in the middle of a concrete city, there's much to enjoy. I think the parks in London are quite extraordinary. I think little touches begin to develop things. Down our street the other year, they've just planted some trees, you know, every sort of 20 metres or so. And the difference in birdsong that's resulted is quite striking. If you have eyes for it among the breathtaking and the hideous of human design in the city, are glimpses of God's beauties too. More than that, he's the God who can't resist the pleasure of making wonderful things. Jenny Brown, who used to be on staff here, often spoke about what she called the unnecessary beauties of the universe. She meant things built into God's design, but frankly invisible to anyone else until a Hubble telescope spotted them. You know, a deep sea adventurer filmed them. A David Attenborough series penetrated the jungle and captured them for us. Beauty is not really made for an audience so much as because God can't stop himself making beauty. I wonder if we've lost our joy and thankfulness in such a creator God. Well, creation enjoyment. I can't afford to finish there. I need to say this as well. If this is all we've got to say about life, it's a wonderful world. It is woefully inadequate. I was brought up on talk of a creator God and a wonderful world, and it was left at that, and it became irrelevant in the face of real experience of life around me. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Lasts no more than about 2 pages in the Bible. Just to fill our minds with a good world will leave us very naive, and sooner, I suspect, rather than later, very disillusioned. The Bible's not naive. See, look down to verse 21 in Colossians 1. Look at what he's going to speak of later on. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ. Created through Christ is what we've been talking about tonight. These are our origins. Put any of us on BBC's Who Do You Think You Are program, you know, investigating family trees, and we can point to these beginnings, and they do shape us. But when we move on to created for Christ, if we're going to fulfill our destiny, the purpose we were made for, then we're going to have to face the alienation and the enmity and the evil, as well as the reconciliation. And that's where this series will take us. Realities of life have to be faced up to, and they can't be ducked. But realities of origins are also realities of life. They shape us too. We are, all of us, our parents' children, aren't we? And most of us can see that in ourselves, sometimes very frustratingly, and other times very excitedly. Well, we and our world are God's creation. And if we don't take account of that, we'll misread life's glories. And we'll struggle with life's temptations without this foundation stone in place. Created through him and for him. It's just the theme our last song picks up. You're the author of creation. You're the Lord of every man, and your cry of love rings out across the land. So let's stand and sing about the word of God the Father from before the world began.